Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to After Things, the podcast that comes after Weird Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friends.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody.
So, Justin, you want to start off with the topic?
Well, rarely discussed figure on this program, Elon Musk, got himself into a bit of a brouhaha on Twitter. This was stemming from a report that he disagreed with or thought was biased about a Tesla plant, and it erupted into several tweets where people were going back and forth with him, in which he not only lamented whether or not the media was trustworthy, the media writ large, but also wanted to know whether or not people in a poll would be interested in a site that allowed people to score and rate journalists, which he defined, I think, as reporters, editors, and publishers with sophisticated bot tracking. So create media credibility rating site that also flags propaganda botnets. Your choices are yes, this would be good, or no, media are awesome. He also joked and said that he would call it Pravda, which I don't know if everybody got that. I think that was pretty clearly a joke, but there is that. Predictably, journalists said, awesome. We look into things all the time. We would very much be excited about people looking into us and rating us as we literally do for every other profession. Just kidding. They said that it was awful and it was terrible and it would never work and it would erode an already crumbling trust in the media that has been exacerbated by insert your political metaphor here. So where do we want to start?
Well, I will, from a totally unbiased point of view, says the guy wearing the SpaceX shirt. Yeah. I would say that we talked about this before about trying to understand incentives and trying to understand sometimes like why does a thing exist? Why does a thing do what it's supposed to do? And you can have the intentions of people involved with it, and then you can have what the outcome is. Google, we want to organize the world's information. YouTube, here's a great platform to share videos and stuff. And then why are people from ISIS using this? You know, and it's like, well, this is what happens. You know, why are people Facebook? Hey, why are we people yelling at each other over politics? Because it magnifies. It does this. You know, Elon Musk, you know, in some regards, it's comical to people to go, why is this guy who's worth gazillions of dollars and heads these big companies kind of ranting against the media like, you know, your father or something? Why is he doing this when he's a guy who's in power and he's in control? And part of it is that as powerful as somebody like Elon Musk is, one article in a large enough platform can send stock prices going down, can attack him personally, can still affect him. So no matter how much control you may have in some areas, getting criticism or dealing with this from other sources can still have an impact, can still make a difference. And, you know, the history of powerful people being frustrated by the media didn't start last week. And, you know, you can look at like, and even the new economy, you know, one of the things that happens when you're a powerful company, when you have a lot of different wheels in place and you're very dependent upon a lot of what you want to do on public opinion, and you feel that, hey, somebody can unfair one article that's poorly sourced or one article that actually comes from a hidden source, which is a problem that's meant to derail you, can derail what you're trying to do and cost you a lot, is frustrating. Remember the 90s, remember what Microsoft did? They went to NBC, said, let's do a partnership. We'll call it MSNBC. Now it's totally going to be this independent sort of thing, which largely it was. But the goal of this was to promote technology and computers and the new media and sort of stuff, and also become, you know, give Microsoft a foothold in media. You know, and that was where MSNBC came from. The MS was Microsoft. You had, you know, Carlos Slim, you know, was owner of like 20% of New York Times and also like not just what he owned from the shares, but a big debt holder to it. He would loan them money. New York Times, arguably one of the most influential newspapers in the entire world, Carlos Slim, for a period of time, the richest man in the world. The richest man in the world, you know, was the guy that was lending money to the most influential newspaper in the world. Now, did that affect the newsroom? Did it affect that? That's a different discussion. But obviously, he saw an interest in there. He thought a financial reason to do this. Jeff Bezos now owns, you know, the Washington Post, you know, and owns this. Jeff Bezos is now the richest man in the world who has decided that I want to own a newspaper. Now, are we seeing signs of Machiavellian, you know, manipulation and what's going on there? I don't know. I don't think so. But there still is. This guy's now employs tons of reporters, tons of places, you know, things, you know, people in that interest because he has a concern about the media. Washington Times. Who owns the Washington Times?
I don't know. Do you know, Justin?
I'm just going to say the Moonies.
Yep. The Unification Church. So they started this back in the early 80s and they wanted to do this. So there's clearly been this. And that is, you know, Elon Musk found an article that reinforced what he wanted to say. And he linked to this sort of not too well-known news site. Ooh. And whoops, turned out it was a group that was associated with Nexium, whatever, the sort of the sex cult sort of thing. And and somebody pointed this out to Elon Musk and he's like, whoops, deleting my tweet on that one. But and that's, you know, you have all these different interests.
His follow up was, it's a shame because it was more accurate than non-cult related media.
and I guess that gets into it, because if you can certainly get into, you know, where does the frustration come from? And I think a lot of his frustration has come from there's been, you know, a lot of attacks on Tesla and, you know, it's a big company, has a lot of customers and a lot of employees, and it's going to be doing things that, you know, that are open to fair criticism. And his frustration has come from, I think there was the article Justin mentioned where, you know, there had been reports of like, oh, they, you know, employee, you know, that they're, you know, it's a bad place. Elon Musk is a bad person because these bad things are happening there. And his point is like, that's not true. This is the UAW and, you know, backing this, whatever. But he feels it was unfairly presented. And he's dealt with this other times with reporters who, if you type in Elon Musk and arrogant or whatever, you will find no shortage of people criticizing him, sometimes for things that seem to be legit concerns, but sometimes just because it's Elon Musk, you know.
I brought this up the other week, but I am fascinated with where we are in our current culture and the backlash to Elon Musk specifically, because on his face, he's kind of the he's not the faceless banker guy. He's not, right, you know, some executive at Morgan Chase. He's not even a venture capital, you know, he's not Peter Thiel, right? Who has certainly been involved with a lot of successes, but now is more of a behind the scenes, you know, board member and engaging in venture capital. He's a doer. And he's doing things that theoretically are even in the zeitgeist of a popular culture, things that we want to move forward. Electric vehicles, space exploration, somebody who at the forefront of all of his companies, he says, is a reaction to what he believes is the very real problem of man-made climate change, right? Like, this is somebody that you would think is kind of tailor-made to be praised. And certainly he has and was, and we've certainly lavished plenty of it on this show. But I almost wonder how much of it is a backlash to that. How much of it is a backlash to just wealth? How much of it is a backlash to the fact that he is a chesty guy on Twitter who likes to, you know, be coy and sometimes venomous?
Yeah, certainly. And I think, you know, and I will say, like, you know, the Twitter thing, like, you know, some people have good days, some people have bad days. Sometimes people go on social media and react to things. And sometimes, you know, you wish, like, man, probably would have been better to take a few beats on that one before figuring out to respond, because it's not going to have the result you want, kind of thing. But, you know, if Elon Musk was taking advice from me and the rest of the world about how to live his life, we would not be in the remarkable position we are today with a lot of the achievements. It's like Steve Jobs, like, you know, like Steve Jobs, by all accounts, there was jerk mode and he could be a complete jerk to people. Like, there are enough stories that I believe that is. Steve Jobs is a hero to me and I don't want to live up to those ideals. But man, I don't know what I'm supposed to. I don't know what dial we change and still get the same outcome.
Bryce, do you hate Elon Musk? Do you recoil whenever we talk good about Sir Elon?
I don't know. I think I'm very mixed on him. Very clearly, the primary objectives of the many companies he started and the technologies he's created are meant for the human good. But I also don't. I don't know if I would get on with him as friends. You know, I think that's maybe kind of where I'm at. I was like, I don't know. You're doing you. I don't know. We would gel. As far as like hate him, I don't hate Elon Musk.
Do you understand the backlash? If you were to explain the backlash, how would you explain it?
If I had to take a crack at it, it would probably be that he comes across as like tone deaf.
Okay.
I would say he is one of a handful of people who are both hyper wealthy and very what's a good word? Very vocal on social media, or just a very, you know, forward PR person for themselves.
But he's got hand waving syndrome, excessive hand waving of like, oh, whatever. Like, people have a problem with the Tesla plant. It's UAW getting, you know, people have a problem with SpaceX. It's these other people. People have the autopilot's malfunctioning. It's this other thing. Like,
so let me throw something out there though. It's like, and Bryce, like, yeah, there are people who I look up to and admire, but I don't know if I'd want to be in a room with them for very long because there just wouldn't be room in there, you know. But that's fine because they're doing the thing that they do and they do it very, very well. Mm-hmm. What I find fascinating about Elon Musk, and there's now the comparison's been drawn to our president, Donald Trump, is that, you know, these guys, there's something on their mind. They tell us. We don't get a press release. We don't get this. They say on Twitter. And then Elon's case is he interacts with people for better or for worse. Is you've watched some people when they see that they can get a reaction out of him, he'll react to people. You get some people who say, you know, you read some of the stuff said directly to him from people. He's a guy that wants to
directly,
he's a guy that wants to be around a bunch of other people and like, hey, let's hang out, let's talk kind of guy in some regard. Yeah. But then when you have the impact he does, when you all of a sudden open yourself up to what these lot of people who don't like you are saying, who don't like you from a variety of reasons, whether they, you know, they're, you know, a hedge fund that's got $1 billion on the line that they may be about to lose the next few months if the Model 3 production keeps continuing its improvements like it has, or people who have a problem with wealth, you know, people have a problem with wealth, you know, and you look at some people or people who have a problem that he has fans, you know, people that like him. And, you know, you read some of the criticism from journalists who go to these events, you know, where like the Boring Company, and you get this sort of snide and all the Musk bites or the Musk fans showed up. And it's this, you know, do you do that at a campaign rally? You know, were you upset that, you know, the politicians you like have people who like what they're doing? Is that a problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, I mean, that, and I think maybe that's an element of it also is like there are multifaceted and complicated issues, many of which that we've brought up, you know, even just in this discussion. And I don't think Elon Musk is the type of person to he's going to defend himself, and he's going to like any person would want to, which is, you know, give their side. And what we all do is we will sometimes say things in a particular way so that, you know, framing certain stuff. It's tough. You know, you can't expect him to be the final answer on these tough issues because he's going to be coming from his own side. And there are certain, I think there are people on both sides of the spectrum. It has been interesting. In terms of like the, what did you say? The Elon heads, the Musk heads.
Muskvites, Musk fans, yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
There was some tweet where I guess over the weekend he had replied to someone saying, "Oh, I'm not having a very good day right now," or "I'm not having a very good time right now." And there were people like, "Oh, will it make you feel better if I buy stock in Tesla or something?" Like, very weird. It's a very weird worship culture, and it's not exclusive to.
Oh no, that's Twitter. Like, yeah. That's, I mean, yeah. You see, like, go find a famous person on Twitter that tweets a lot and go and dive into those replies, and you will see some strange things.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I. You know, if you go to the Reddit, Elon Musk, I can't even pronounce his name right now, the Elon Musk threads, you know, you'll see a lot of just like, it's people ready to be a mob and cheer the hero kind of person. It's kind of like, hey, dial back, like, let's support what he's doing, you know, and just because he has a bad day on Twitter doesn't mean that we all have to pick up pitchforks and defend our hero, yeah. You know, kind of thing. So I'm like, be like, oh, yeah, no, we hear you. It's okay. But back to the point of like the Yelp for journalism kind of thing, like, I love the idea. I don't know how it'll work, but like, and I noticed, but it's Justin pointed out, like, journalists do not like to take criticism. They do not handle it well. If you have ever corrected somebody, a journalist, on a factual point, and it's, you will know in a polite, like, hey, just this thing, whatever. And you'll be either told like, okay, thanks. And good ones tend to say, okay, cool, got it, if you're right. Other ones will say, not important. You know, I've had that before. Like, just so you know, this thing, this number here is actually this. Here's the source one. I'm like, I don't think it's really that important to the thing. It's like, wow, you do not give an F, you know, about your job. And I don't think I need to read you anymore, because if I pick this one up, what do I not know? You know, but in journalists, you know, serve media companies that have to get eyeballs, and the journalist can say, my job is to cover the truth. Your job is to get clicks. You know, that's,
but yeah. Is that at the hands of the individual journalists? Is it at the hands of the editors in chief, the people who are passing out assignments, green lighting assignments? Like, is it at the individual level that the concern is?
Here's the argument, I think, from the journalist side.
Yeah.
You know, there's an old saying with journalism, you know, the hours are long and the pay is bad, but at least at the end of the night, everyone hates you. and like, there is a sense, and I've certainly felt it in the brief career I had in journalism, that, you know, your first, unless somebody is intentionally, like, they have a working relationship with you, or they are actively looking to feed you things, there's hesitation that you have to deal on every facet with people that you talk to in your job, because you have to, at the very least, prove yourself to be a worthwhile steward to get this information out. So I think that ultimately creates a sense of, you know, immediate kind of reflex when anybody questions that people aren't working very hard. And you see a lot of the same kind of mob mentality, where an attack on one journalist is an attack on all journalists, which I think is unhelpful, because it's, I don't think it generally makes us more trustworthy of people when everybody's sticking up for the institution. The only thing I'll say is this. My opinion, as somebody who was a journalist and now is outside of it and is doing my own independent thing, it's Elon Musk's right to push back on a report. He theoretically knows more about it than the reporter does. He should be able to say what he wants to about it. And I think that, to Bryce's point, there is probably a disconnect for when Elon says and fiercely defends Tesla or SpaceX or something, how much we see his Twitter account and say, oh, what a thin-skinned baby, can't take criticism. And in his mind, he's thinking about the hundreds of people that are employed with him, that it's their reputations that are on the line, and he would rather be the person with his sword and shield tackling this than having somebody else, you know, think that he's not sticking up for them on his own team. But in my opinion, he should be able to push back, and they should create a Yelp for journalists. Like, this, the point when you are a journalist, in my opinion, is the truth wins out. And it's why you are endowed with the First Amendment, because that's your one thing. Don't be malicious and let the truth win out and be as objective as possible.
You know, one of the things, the trends that happened over the last 6 years, five, 6 years, is major sites got rid of comment section. A lot of major sites got rid of comment sections, which was in the golden day of what the internet's going to be, is news sites are moving online and like, oh, and we can have comments and stuff. And then you got people saying horrible things and you got people fighting, but you also get a lot of it. You get a lot of sites and it's people tearing apart the journalists because they click, you know, the headline, oh, this sounds interesting, and they disagree and they do that. And it used to be, you know, news sites would encourage journalists like, oh, engage with people in the comments. We want this, you know, and that didn't last long because, you know, some sites they do it, some sites they don't, but it's become like a lot of major news organizations, they don't do that anymore. They got rid of that entirely. And that was a place to be sort of held accountable, but then to a degree, at least to hear that, but if you can get rid of that, then that's fine. But now, you know, the idea of, hey, let's be able to evaluate that. Cause part of the problem is like, you know, you take like, you've been following what's happening to Jordan Peterson.
Ancillarily. Yeah.
So Jordan Peterson, a Canadian psychologist who's written, you know, extensively in his own sort of point of view on roles, modern society, things like this, whatever. Very, very interesting sort of, you know, point of view on stuff, which would be considered, you know, center right on that. And, you know, he's talked about like, you know, why did the average German, you know, become part of the Holocaust? Why did they become part of the problem, the Nazi Germany? Why are they part of this thing, the rise of that? But because he's coming from a right and he's actually a bit of a religious person, you know, he's got that point of view on that. You're getting pieces that are saying, you know, like trying to equate him to a Holocaust denier. And this guy could not be more equivocal that it happened and it was horrible and all this. But they're like, well, shouldn't you be doing more? Because, you know, outright hit pieces saying, oh, you know, he's become this leader for the far right. And it's like you get far, and they point to an article where some far right person satirically mentions him. But you get this sort of momentum of just this, you know, you look at Jordan Peterson's, you read, you know, a piece that just makes him out to be a monster. Then you read his point of view on what he's trying to say. And you realize like, oh, wow, this is, there are people in the media ganging up on him because they disagree with him because there is a political slant or point of view. And that's problematic. And you don't really have, you know, if you're a guy like Jordan Peterson, who certainly has a growing audience, but if you're a guy like that on the rise and somebody decides to write a piece on you in the New York Times and basically describe you, you know, as worse than Hitler, you're going to spend so much time trying to define, trying to say, no, I'm not, you don't even get your message out.
So, to bring it to the idea for a Yelp for journalists, maybe it would be interesting to hypothesize what that is or what that looks like, how that works. There was some talk of, well, is it machine learning? Is there an artificial intelligence element to it? Is it user reviews? I think within all of that, you will find they each have their own unique issues and concerns, right? If you look at if you go a full user rating and user review based, you can look at something like Steam, the video games launcher, which constantly has to deal with, you know, oh, here's a group of people who don't like this thing about this game or this thing about the decision that this company made. And so they're all going to, you know, review bomb this title. And so it shows up poorly and it's open to abuse. And then you have artificial intelligence, which, you know, someone has to be the arbiter of what is a success and a failure in terms of the results of that. What do you guys think is the best way to go about this? If we take the foundation that a site like this can be generally good.
It's a complicated thing and you have to try different solutions towards it. I get frustrated when I click through a headline and I go, oh, this was clickbaity, it's not answering this, or it's this. If I had known this person was the one that wrote it, I never would have clicked on it because I think they do garbage journalism. You know, I see that in like aerospace, things like that, and science stuff and things like this. Like, oh, this sounds interesting. I'm like, oh, and it's not because, oh, I disagree. It's like, no, they didn't source this. They didn't go this. They keep going back to the same resource for this, whatever. And I get frustrated in politics too. is it, I like contrary points of view, but I like really thought out ones. When I click through something and I find out it's an opinion piece, you know, I always hate that because I'm like, I don't care what your opinion, show me what the facts say and then build it something from there. I think, yeah, individual journalist, you could say, hey, here's this, like somebody mentioned in here, like rate my professor, you know, like how do you rate this thing? You could do that. And it's going to get abused. It's going to have problematic. But if you find a way to say like, you know, like Amazon reviews where you go in there and that's got problems, but like, let me read the negative ones and see, you know, if it's, if there's a book that, you know, Hillary Clinton's book comes out and there's a ton of 1-star reviews, let me see those. Cause are there just people clicking 1-star cause they don't like her? Mm-hmm. Then, you know, then make it, you know, let's make that very clear. Cause then you want to weigh it on somebody who's actually read it.
Sure. I think one thing that something like Amazon or Steam have going for it in terms of reviews is that they're able to know when people have invested in an item, whether they've purchased it, whether they've bought it, whether they've played it, how long they've spent with it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's something that like Steam is very uniquely able to filter down. It'll show next to your review, you know, verified purchase, spent 6.1 hours playing this game, thumbs up or thumbs down. And the comment to where they will like, because review bombs are such a big thing on Steam, they will do like a timeline basically of opinion on it. And so you can actually see the spikes of where there has been concentrated efforts
to move the needle.
Right. Metacritic is another very similar thing where some game developers put Metacritic scores into the contracts of the games that they make. And users will go and try to tank the user Metacritic score because for whatever reason they don't like a game. I think it would be tough because I don't think that there's I don't think there's quite a trackable investment level for a 100% human based rating.
But you know, so let's understand that it's imperfect, yeah. Right? I think the one thing that would be very, very valuable is, you know, here are two kind of sports examples, because sports is a very frivolous branch of journalism, in my opinion, in general.
You hear that, sports journalists? You're frivolous.
Yeah. Oh, they can eat it, all of them.
To be replaced by computers.
That's right.
In terms of gamer stuff, but like, two journalists that are very, very respected that do kind of opposite things. And now I think they're both employed by ESPN, but they've kind of spawned their own branches of journalism. One is like Zach Lowe, who does NBA stuff. Both of them are NBA reporters, actually. But he does very, not like dry, but certainly like objective sort of X's and O's. These are the kinds of strategies that teams are employing. Universally liked, by and large. Like, if you read his comment section on ESPN, it's usually, thank you for writing this. I'm very happy to have read your article. On the other end of the spectrum, one of the biggest guys in terms of, like, scoops is Adrian Wojnarowski, who is, like, the guy who reports that your team just traded their best player. Like, he is known for those kinds of reports. He is similarly lauded for what he does, but you know that he's in a speculative art form. You know, the other guy's in a very granular art form, and they've branded themselves as such. And I think if I were to take a guess as the pathway forward in journalism, is that the vestigial tail that we have is, I think, what pisses people off a lot, which is journalists as and editors as narrative setters, as opposed to information analyzers. Well, and I think that's where I think you would see those kinds of reporters be voted down and those kinds of outlets be voted down because they're going to be more controversial. And the ones that will rise to the top are those that are doing things that a lot of people like and consider of worth. And then the second phase, and Elon even said, is what would happen. And the reason why this would be a success is that it's just like Rotten Tomatoes. All these studios can bitch about how Rotten Tomatoes is tanking their movies and it's unfair. But then as soon as one of their movies gets a fresh rating gets an 80%, gets a 90%. Guess what's on their commercial? Because it's social proof that it's good. And if the New York Times was higher than the Washington Post, do you think that they wouldn't say verified by readers as more trustworthy than any other major daily? Of course they would.
Yes. I think that it's these things, these outsider ways of evaluating things are outsider until people say, yeah, let's go do this. You know, and I think that, yeah, if you're a journalist, it's the idea that all of a sudden you're going to see your name on a website and you're going to be at the whim of other people judging whether or not, you know, you're a good journalist or not, even though you know how hard you work, it's terrifying. Nobody wants to be judged, particularly people who know the power of that. And as you pointed out, Justin, in the newsroom was just that, like, the power the editors have in setting the narrative. And that's frustrating to a guy like Elon Musk, is that one news report, newspaper paper or one blog or whatever does a story fine, but then it gets picked up and carried. Elon Musk was upset about something that happened earlier. Was there was, you know, a Tesla got into a car accident in Fort Lauderdale, right? Made national news. And Elon Musk is, you know, there are 100 car accidents a day. Why is this one being covered? Because it's Tesla. And he got a reaction journalist, you know, like, oh, so we're not supposed to cover? We're not supposed to cover when you get into accidents? And the point wasn't that you shouldn't cover it, but it's, yeah, Sun Sentinel sounds like a relevant story for the Sun Sentinel. The only reason it went national, the only reason other bloggers and news agencies picked it up, though, was because of the name Tesla, not because Tesla has an outsized dangerous reputation or, you know, outsized, you know, real danger, you know, which can be questioned or looked into, but because everybody knows the name Tesla, Elon Musk is in the news, and Tesla, whenever something, you know, robots fail or whatever like that, it's sensational. And that's the sort of the argument is, like, the reason it went national wasn't because the fact that there's a car accident is national news. It's because the name, and, you know, why did, it's not, why did it? And so the argument went from somebody was, he's saying, like, frustrated that it got all that coverage, but the reporter's like, oh, so we shouldn't cover this. It's like, no, the reporter who wrote that original article locally should have covered it. Uh-huh. Why did you feel the need to repeat it? Because you knew it'd get clicks.
But if are clicks a bad, if we're saying that, like, let's say the reporting on it was accurate, at least, are clicks not a good metric for that?
No, I mean, look, Elon Musk's a famous person. Tesla's the first American automotive company to have come along in a very long time. This is newsworthy for a lot of different reasons, not to mention the fact that autopilot is something that's going to be highly scrutinized because it's the most widely deployed version of a technology that we assume will only become a larger part of our lives. And to be honest, frightens a lot of people just on its face. So there's a reason why these things are newsworthy. The question is, you know, and to be honest, I again, Elon should push back on it. I don't have a problem with him pushing back on it, nor do I think I find him to be thin-skinned, because I think he understands that there is, you know, you write one story and it's a thing. You write two stories, now it's a trend. You write three stories and now all of a sudden some member of the state legislature wants to get their name in the paper because they know that if they introduce an anti-blank legislation, even if they know that it's not going to pass, that now it introduces it to another quadrant of lawmakers seek to stop Tesla. That's your headline. That's not factually incorrect, but the likelihood that it will make it pass there or if it will be enforceable will be something different. And then if that gets traction, now maybe a national lawmaker does it, right? Or, you know, Elon is in two businesses that are heavily dependent on federal regulation, the automotive industry and rockets, right? Or and in the rocket case, down investment, right? The NASA's purchasing of services from SpaceX is a gigantic part of the revenue. So he has to... He would be ignorant to not manage the PR. And at the very least, if all he can do is get out his contrary point of view via his Twitter account, then that's what he is going to do. And I have no problem with him doing it.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, but I also don't have a problem with people writing about it. I think at the end of the day, we're going to find out what's closer to the truth. You know, and we should be critical of journalistic outlets that propagate something other than that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. So, yeah, I have no problem. I think a Yelp for journalists would be fascinating because, man, it would be the first time that I could remember journalists having to check something as frequently as authors check their Amazon ranking. Like, it would be compulsive. It would be intense. So I would be interested whether or not it'd be accurate. Oh, man. Man, would it be interesting to watch.
It's not fun when that, you know, when it's wheeled against you. And as journalists individually don't feel very powerful. They don't feel like they have, you know, they're trying to defend their job, trying to defend, you know, as media empires, as the newsrooms get smaller and smaller and smaller, you're in a frustrating position where you don't certainly feel very powerful. But, you know, when that scrutiny is aimed at you, it's very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. Sure. Very awkward. And I'd say back to the Elon Musk point too, it's like a lot of it gets personal. A lot of the stuff that you read, a lot of the commentary about him is just, it's not just talking about the businesses, but, you know, being accused, you know, people doing mind reading to assume that they know why he's doing these things and assuming bad motives, you know, and that probably, you know, anybody has trouble dealing with that, particularly somebody who likes to be in front of people or talking to people and engaging with people who feels that he's sincere. It's not, you know, can't be easy to pick up, you know, pick up your Kindle or your iPad and see, hey, here's somebody in the Atlantic calling me an a-hole. Oh, here's somebody here, this professor here who's an urban planner who's saying, you know, that I'm arrogant or whatever. And there's a big tech lash. There's this big backlash now against, you know, Silicon. And it's not new. It's been going on since the 1990s. The backlash has always been there against Silicon Valley and some of these, you know, outsized personalities and stuff. But there is, I would say, from academia and whatnot, people who feel powerless feel like they've got to use sharper knives now. But, you know, the people that are sailing are real. So problem solved.
there we go. Hit send. You're welcome, Elon.
So my goal is, what I think we need is like a platform where I go and we create accounts and we can share articles with each other. I can say, hey, I just read this thing. This is pretty cool. And you guys could share articles you think is cool. And then you could like it, you know, and then if you like it, it's good. And then maybe we have an algorithm that might decide to sort of say, hey, let's promote more of these articles that you know, Justin likes or Bryce likes.
That sounds
like a foolproof plan.
It sounds a lot like Facebook.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
No, it's different because it's going to work because I'm going to like stuff. And yeah, it's going to, you know, promote the stuff that we like and we're into, Bryce.
Yeah. Well, but also like sharing stuff with people. Like what if it wasn't just news articles? What if it was just your own thoughts? And then
you can do that too. Sure, yeah. Sure.
What if you could separate them into communities and they could each be their own community, right? And you could vote it up or vote it down or.
Yeah.
Well, just vote up. Just vote up. Keep it positive.
Okay. Okay.
Just like it, you know. There you go. See? Yeah, that's the problem. It's like you saw it with Facebook on the surface. You're like, yeah, this sounds like what could go wrong? And I would argue nothing really went wrong. Nothing went wrong. The platform did what it was supposed to do, but people were surprised that the platform did the thing that it was supposed to do. You know,
it scaled. And so all of the very little problems with that grew as Facebook grew.
And I don't know that they were a big problem. I don't know that. I know that people were upset. You know, people are upset because there are a lot of people in every election, but in this one really upset with the outcome of the election, and particularly people who are, you know, in the media and elsewhere, or whatever, and want to look for why did this happen? And you know, it's better to point to one thing rather than a lot of things, or just to say this is the way democracies work. But, you know, all of a sudden, was it a problem when it worked to our advantage? The last two previous elections, you know, when manipulation was taking place and people were buying, you know, data to do things like that, was it okay then? When did the system break down? Well, when we had an outcome that we weren't happy with.
Foreign interference. I mean, now we're getting into a whole.
I know, but point is, it's like maybe it's doing exactly what we wanted to do, things that these things can't do or shouldn't do.
And look, these are growing pains. These are platforms that yes, like they're designed to do with things, and yes, Facebook could have been more proactive about a lot of different things, but they weren't, and they are learning as they go. These are big things that don't have a tremendous amount of precedent. So,
yeah. If you want to see an example of how it works when everybody tries to get together and figure out on the right way to do stuff, pull up videos of Occupy Wall Street and watch the little group meetings of people trying to decide who gets to talk and in what order.
Oh, yeah.
And people with very good intentions, very, very good intentions, and who feel like they sat down thinking, we're all on the same page here, right? And then, no, we're not. We're not. And I will turn over the talking stick now. Any picks?
Here's a little wellness pick for you. To go along with my water pick last week.
It was not a water pick.
No, I picked water.
You picked water.
Free, by the way. Still free water. So I got a smart scale.
Oh.
Did the Selfish Ledger print this out for you?
Gurus is the brand. But you can sync it up with your phone, and it's just another way to kind of keep data. I have been very critical as Andrew laughs at me and my vulnerability.
I'm just like, I need another thing to tell me I'm fat. You know, like push notification. Yep, still fat. Okay, thanks.
It's not that. It's not that. Although certainly that would be the parody of it. No, I mean, it's just been helpful as I've gotten back from recovering from the back injury. Like, I'm now more into kind of a full tilt kind of workout regime like I was before I got injured. And it has been helpful to at least keep track. And like anybody who's working out, you know, you see trends, and it's helpful to kind of see those things in stark relief. And it was easier for me to be able to have it be kind of not thinking about it tracked, then having to remember in my head, oh yeah, well, what was I yesterday and what am I tomorrow? And you know, if that's a thing that you're looking to do, then I've enjoyed it.
How, if this is not too personal, how often are you weighing yourself?
How fat are you?
No.
once in the morning, I'll do it at the same time in the morning. So at the very least I can kind of keep a baseline.
Okay.
And I have lost 3 pounds. Thank you.
So
since when I bought the scale like 2 weeks ago.
And like, how often are you checking the app? Like, is it
just when I weigh myself? I'll look when I weigh myself, and that's it.
Okay. Huh.
But then it also, I guess it does also kick into HealthKit, the Apple like thing, so I guess it could theoretically feed into other stuff if I wanted it to, but I don't really want it to right now.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in weighing yourself a lot. Like, I have a scale in my hallway, and so I weigh myself a couple times a day because I try to get that range of stuff. Because the problem is people, you know, if you're a male who weighs, you know, 190, your average weight, you can lose. I can have a 7 pound fluctuation, you know, if I go from being super dehydrated to drinking a lot, then eating a lot in a day or whatever, I can have a wild variation. A lot of the problems people have is like, oh, I've been on my diet a week, I lost 2 pounds. Like, how often do you weigh? How do you know? It's 2 hours hard to know, because it's like, it's, you know, it's two big gulps, you know, and that's the problem is, you know, people often have very bad data, and the more used to you are to getting a lot of data. And I think a smart scale is a good idea, because it'll help you figure out if you're having trouble figuring out that trend or you want someone to keep track of it. Totally agree. Totally think it could be very useful, because a lot of people have a very naive assumption about how much their weight naturally fluctuates. They think maybe a pound or two, but they don't realize that. Yeah, no, you just had 8 bottles of water. And that's it.
Yeah.
It has been a good step toward weight loss. Not as effective as having your friend laugh at you during your mentioning of it, but
no,
you know, it's still a step in the right direction.
Oh my goodness.
I was thinking more from me, my point of view, if I had a scale, like my fear of just, you know, notifications, more notifications to depress me.
Sure. That's exactly how I read it.
I don't even know. I had a birthday weekend. I ate a lot of cake, ate a lot of pizza,
yeah.
ate a lot of things. And I was coming back from being like one of the most fit points in my life. And then all of a sudden just wrecked all of that. So,
yeah, no, I definitely, the reason why I was down like 7 pounds and then I wound up going to like watch the basketball game and I like ate wings and then I've been trying to stay away from beer, but I drank beer and the next thing you know, boom.
Those 7 pounds
it's
of beer.
5 pounds just whoop, raced.
I have a pick.
Go.
All right.
There's a new podcast. There's only one episode out. It also looks like they are only doing episodes once a month called Dark Ages. And it is a fictional dramedy that takes place inside of a museum in a high fantasy world. And so you follow the staff of the Museum of Mostly Natural Histories as they are preparing for their new big exhibit. And you learn about, you get a good sense of all the different characters, and they all have their own individual voices, and there's a good chemistry between them. It's really well scripted and written, and the production value on it is very good. A lot of great sound design that goes into it, in terms of music, sound effects, mixing. I think it's really cool, and it's brand new, so I want to give them a bump as much as I can help them out. You can get it at darkagesshow.com, or if you look up Dark Ages, you'll probably be able to find it on your podcast catchers. I don't know. There are not very many like drama, like scripted audio plays, basically, that I listen to, but I really like this. So.
It's nice. Great premise. Great premise.
Yeah.
So my pick is I read this week The Intuition Pumps by Daniel Dennett. And maybe I'll talk on this another show, but did I tell you my whole experiment of just using a Kindle and taking that around, like if I'm in the restroom or laying in bed or whatever?
Yeah, you that was your pick last week, I believe.
That's been working out really well. I've been reading way more than I've read, you know, probably read more, you know, in the last week and a half, last 2 weeks, than I probably have in the last 6 months.
Wow.
As far as actual reading. Mm-hmm. So it's been a wonderful, wonderful use of my time was just get a dedicated device, you know, to read with and take that with me when I'm in the smallest room in the house or I'm just sitting in bed and instead of reaching for the phone or the tablet and surfing for the news and the same sites over and over again, just read a book. So Intuition Pumps by Daniel Dennett. It's a book about Daniel Dennett's a wonderfully amazing philosopher. I've always been a big fan of his. He talks about a lot of things about understanding consciousness. He makes very good arguments to explain consciousness. Intuition Pumps comes from here are ways to sort of thinking puzzles or exercises or things to look at ways to look at arguments, ways to form them or whatever, how to analyze some other arguments from other people. And, you know, he has his critics and he, you know, dispatches with their arguments and he makes the case for him, for his view of consciousness, of which I agree with, you know, to me, it makes sense to me, his theory on artificial intelligence, et cetera, whatever. I find that there's a lot of overlap. And that was one of the things I realized early on was I would read several people individually who weren't, you know, coming from a body of, you know, like on consciousness, I'd read Daniel Dennett, go, man, this guy makes a lot of sense. And then I'd go pick up Richard Dawkins and let's say Stephen Jay Gould. I'm like, man, I like Dawkins more than Gould's approach towards this. And then I'd find out that Dennett and Dawkins, you know, there was an overlap there, that there was like, yes, this is compatible with this. And then I'd pick up like Steven Pinker and I'd be like, wow, there's a compatibility here between these. And like Matt Ridley, and even though individually I realized, wow, these people all have independently kind of come to some of the same points of view and then have actually shared some perspectives on stuff. And so Daniel Dennett's a person that if you like Richard Dawkins and you like Steven Pinker, you'll probably like him a lot. And then if you like Matt Ridley, you know, for that. So, but I'll tell you the funny thing though, is that I can, politically speaking, you could see where some of these people, how these beliefs may manifest in current events will be very, very different, which to be explained. But from a psychological or looking at how the world works point of view, I think it's very interesting. So cool. Intuition nice. Pumps, highly recommend it. Really good explanation of some of the rudiments of consciousness.
Wow.
So that's my pick. I guess that's it. It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.